this relation's gear, crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have. God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
Audra McDonald has already had a wide-ranging career on stage and screen, from Carousel to Henry IV to the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, so it may not come as a shock that the five-time Tony Award-winning actress has chosen to bring the great jazz singer Billie Holiday to life in the play Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. It's at Circle in the Square Theater on West 50th Street and Broadway, and it's running through August 10th, and I'm very pleased it has brought Audra McDonald to our show today. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
The play takes place at Emerson's Bar and Grill, which was an actual place?
Yes. It was a tiny little rundown club in Philadelphia, which it no longer stands. I think it's a parking lot now.
But this was just 3 months before Billie died.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes quite clear very quickly that she's a mess.
Yes, yeah.
Why was she still performing when she was in such poor health?
She needed the money.
I heard that she had 70 cents in her bank account when she died. She was in police custody in a New York hospital.
Yes, in Metropolitan Hospital. Actually, there's lots of stories about what was actually in her bank account, which she really never had much control over anyway. It was all the men in her life who controlled her finances. But at this point, she's estranged from her husband, Louis McKay. And she did an interview on her deathbed with William Dufty, who co-wrote Lady Sings the Blues with her, and just so she could get some cash. And the amount of money is in dispute. Some say it was $750, some say it was other amount. But when she died, according to William Dufty, the reason that William Dufty knew that she had passed is because a nurse came out with the $50 bills that she had rolled up and supposedly inserted in the most personal orifice she could find.
To protect herself in the hospital.
But literally. Just so she had something. The nurse said, here's the money. And that's how they knew, okay, she's passed.
Now, you've obviously done research.
Yes, I have.
Would you have to research a role like this other than seeing some film footage of Billie in the later years and listening to the records?
Absolutely, because you need to know. You need to know her mental state. You need to know what had happened in her life, what she was thinking about. There's everything that had gone on from, basically birth on in terms of just trials and tribulations as far as Billie Holiday is concerned, from basically being abandoned by her parents, being raped when she was 10, being in jail, being a prostitute, all these things.
And then becoming one of the greatest singers, jazz singers that ever lived.
That ever lived. And for, to some degree, being recognized for that while she was still alive, never receiving the actual sort of financial and emotional support she needed, but she was lauded in her day. So I needed to know all the history, but especially at this particular moment in her life, in March of 1959, the cirrhosis is really starting to take effect as far as her legs were very swollen, her stomach was very swollen from the cirrhosis. She was having a hard time breathing, hard time walking. Standing up on stage was very difficult. She would sway from side to side. And she had also just lost Lester Young, who was basically her soulmate. He had died about a week before this concert. And at this, at his funeral, she wasn't allowed to sing, and she was devastated, and they had to take her away and take her to a bar and calm her down. She had been turned down for trying to adopt a couple of foster children. So she was truly alone at this point. So I needed to know all those things going into this moment in this concert with her.
Well, the play is structured in a way where she's singing songs and then talking to the audience in between and pretty much tells the story of her life and her trials and tribulations and reveals, of course, how important Lester Young was to her, but also Bessie Smith, Louis Armstrong, but Lester Young to some degree, because she almost, some critics have claimed she's kind of like the vocal version of Lester Young. They both had, she based her style to some degree on
Lester.
His amazing tenor saxophone play.
Sure, sure. And Lester would say, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he would say, you know, she was up there singing like a horn player. And a lot of people would say there was a voice in Lester Young's horn, mm-hmm. and there was a horn in Billie Holiday's voice.
Now, she also improvised.
Absolutely.
What's happening with you here? You're not, your background isn't as a jazz singer, but
no.
you make a very effective jazz singer here. Are you pretty much singing it the same way every night?
No, I'm not. I'm trying to improvise as much as I possibly can in the way that Billie Holiday would have. You know, Billie Holiday would get very bored of singing the song the same way twice, and she I think one of her famous quotes, she said, I can't even copy me, you know.
Although a lot of other people did. Peggy Lee, Anita O'Day, Frank Sinatra.
Absolutely. Actually, Billie Holiday even called Peggy Lee on it and said, why are you trying to sing like yourself? You know, stop trying to sing like me. But Billie Holiday sort of got her start in, you know, improvisation, not only from listening to Louis Armstrong and Bessie Smith when she was younger, but when she was playing in a lot of those clubs up on 133rd Street, like Pods and Jerry's and I think it was a log cabin before that, you know, they would go from table to table singing songs, and they'd sing the same song over and over from table to table. And so she'd sing it differently at every table she went to.
She talks in the play about being banned from singing in New York nightclubs. From Prohibition to 1967, performers had to obtain a cabaret card in order to perform in New York City clubs. And she wasn't able to make a living because that's where
that was taken away from her after her arrest, which in Philadelphia, which resulted in her having to go to Alderson Prison she was sentenced to a year and a day. And as a result, they took away her cabaret card, so she couldn't perform in these clubs
anymore. And she was in pretty good company. Charlie Parker lost his cabaret card. Chet Baker, Thelonious Monk.
Miles Davis.
Jerry Mulligan, Miles Davis.
Yeah, Stan Getz. And you know what?
And Lenny Bruce, for different reasons. Mm-hmm. He was the only one who wasn't brought up on drug charges.
Right.
For him, it was obscenity.
Obscenity, right. You know, what was sad about Billie Holiday, and she would rail against this sort of policy and talk about it to her death because she kept trying and trying to get it back, is that a lot of those people ended up getting their cards back even though they had been convicted of the exact same things as Billie Holiday. And, you know, she would claim it was misogynistic and racist or whatever, just they were just out to get her, that she was the only one who didn't ever receive her card again.
Well, Jerry Mulligan said he refused to go through the humiliating process,
right.
So he never bothered.
Right.
You and Billie Holiday have such different singing voices, and yet when you start to sing at the beginning of the play, it's just amazing how well that you've captured her voice. How did you find that sound in your own voice?
You know, it's interesting. I really had to, when I was first approached with this idea by Lonnie Price, the director, who was a very good friend of mine, saying, I think you should do this part, I thought he was crazy. He's like, I can't sing like Billie Holiday. I don't know the first thing of being able to sing like her. And then I started, you know, just attempting something in these first couple of workshops we did. And it really, the light went on for me when I discovered a bunch of recordings of rehearsals of Billie Holiday's. And this was in like 1956, rehearsals with Jimmy Rolls and Artie Shapiro in Los Angeles, just in somebody's apartment. They're trying to figure out what they're going to sing on some recording date the next day. And Billie is at ease, slightly inebriated, and having a good time telling stories, cracking jokes, yelling at people. But she's not in that sort of prepared voice that she tries to use when she does interviews with like Mike Wallace and the like. She's really at ease. And her speaking voice in those interviews sounded so much like my grandmother that I thought, that's my way in, because I imitated my grandmother to her face. I got in trouble for it, but that's how I found my way into Billie Holiday's voice, her speaking voice and her singing. I went through my version of my grandmother.
Well, 2 years ago, you were on Broadway as Bess in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. As close to an operatic role as you can get on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to play a little clip from that.
Okay.
I loves you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. keep me.
And now, Audra, here you are singing like Billie Holiday, What a Little Moonlight Can Do.
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do. Wait a while till little moonbeam comes peeping through. You get ball. You can't resist him, and all you say, you have kissed him as what a little moonlight can do.
Audra McDonald, who has kind of taken over the body and voice of Billie Holiday. She's appearing in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill at the Circle in the Square on West 50th Street in a setting that is like a nightclub.
It's quite immersive. Yeah, that certainly was the goal.
Were you as surprised hearing that contrast as everyone else is?
Yes and no. What most people don't know, there's very few people in the world that know what I sound like when I wake up.
Ah, so it's not just your grandmother, it's your early morning voice.
It's my early morning voice. No, it's disturbing.
But do you have to take special care of your voice when you're singing so low in your register?
You know, it's interesting. I still have to warm up every night for this show as if I'm singing an opera. I do a full operatic warm-up so that my voice is fully engaged and as open and as supported as it possibly can. And then at the very end of that warm-up, I do the sort of cat-like sounds that sort of get me into Billie's sort of timbre.
Would it have been different if you were singing a younger Billie Holiday?
Yes, it would have, absolutely. Because the younger Billie, she would even say, you know, when she would listen to her older recording, she's like, I sound so, you know, funny and my voice is high and weird. And it was obviously a healthier sound. And in the very, 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 very early recordings, even though it was a singular sound, you could hear her still sort of trying to imitate a little bit of what was going on during the day, just a little bit. And that, you know, quickly went away, you know, the more she got into it. But I would think even with like her first recording of My Mother's Son-in-Law, Your Mother's Son-in-Law, you would hear just a little bit of the style of the day, that sort of twinkle style of the day.
She brought an emotionality to the music that others hadn't, although even though she describes herself as not as a jazz singer, not a blues singer, it is actually closer in some ways to blues singing, whereas Ella Fitzgerald, miraculous singer, but it's all about musicality with Ella.
Yeah, absolutely.
Virtuosity. Not that Billie wasn't musical.
No. And they were both virtuosic, I think, in their own very separate ways. But I was even in the car on the way down today. What was Ella singing? But Ella came on the radio and she was singing something. And there's just such sunshine in her voice, you know, just such happiness. And even when she's, you know, in her lower register, I mean, you're just hearing the clarity of that sound and the beauty of that sound. And you're not really about to open your wrists. Mm-hmm. And then Billie comes on.
Even up-tempo tunes sometimes sound like
They're
troubled.
Yes. Yeah.
In the play, she describes her experiences touring with Artie Shaw's all-white band in the late 1930s, including going through the segregated South. How did she respond to the segregation and the racism that she and at times the band also faced?
She had a really hard time with it, you know. Whereas she knew she had to deal with it. Whereas other people, you know, especially since she wasn't really raised deep in the South,
Baltimore,
you know, which not really the South, but when she toured way down in the South with Artie, she just wasn't as used to the blatant racism, you know. So she, you know, sometimes at one point there's a famous story of a man saying to Artie Shaw after one number, "Let the nigger wench sing again." And she leaned down to the man who said that and hurled an epithet of curse words at him. And they eventually had to remove her, you know, from the stage. She fought against it.
I'm not going to tell the story, but you do get some of your biggest laughs in recounting a meal that she had in a restaurant in the South with Artie Shaw.
Yeah.
And then the next year she recorded Strange Fruit, which some people have called the first great protest song.
Truly.
Do you think that grew out of that experience?
She found
a poem that she then did she put the melody to the
No, this is a song that Abel Meeropol, who under the pseudonym of Lewis Allen, wrote, and he was a communist, and
he adopted the Rosenberg's children,
and he would sing this at union meetings, or his wife would sing it, and once Barney Josephson opened Cafe Society, which is the first sort of integrated club down in the village, where blacks and whites could sing together and sit together. He approached Billie Holiday and said, "We'd like you to sing." And she was frightened of singing it at first because she thought she would, there would be repercussions for singing it. But
and there were. Her record company, Columbia,
refused to.
Yeah, so she had to. She went to Commodore, and that changed her life in another way. She kind of took over control of her career.
Absolutely, and Commodore, the great thing about the Commodore story, her going down there and, they're just, out of a record shop trying to make these records and saying, yes, we'll do it, is the owner, was Mitt Gabler, his brother, Jack Crystal, was Billy Crystal's father. And that's how Billy Crystal ended up meeting and spending time with Billie Holiday.
My guest is Audra McDonald, who is do we count the dog? One of four performers.
She would count herself, absolutely.
One of the only two speaking roles in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, currently at the Circle in the Square Theater on West 50th Street and Broadway, and it's running through August 10th. Where did the idea for the play come from? This is not a new play, is it?
No, this is a revival. This was written first performed in 1986 at the Vineyard Theater by Lainey Robertson, a wonderful playwright. And he wrote this play based on an experience his boyfriend had had when his boyfriend, before Lainey met him, in 1959, had gone with a friend to Emerson's Bar in Philadelphia, walked in and saw that Billie Holiday was performing, went in and witnessed this concert in which there was about 8 or 9 people in the audience. They said she was drunk from the moment she walked in. She came on stage, stumbled up on stage, brought her dog up on stage to introduce to the audience, barely got through about 12 songs, and then kind of fell off the stage and left. And when Lainey's boyfriend told him this story, he was so moved by it and haunted by it, he kind of couldn't get it out of his head. And he said, "One night I just got up and walked over to the typewriter and thought, I got to write this." And that's how the play was born.
One of the more shocking moments is when she leaves the stage and comes back with her long gloves, one of them down because she's obviously gone off to shoot up some heroin.
Yeah. And, it's interesting. At that point in Billie's life, she would go on and off heroin her entire life. And she, at that point, really didn't have any veins available to her in her arms and was having to use other places. But we used the arm because it's just the most sort of iconic place to show that, and she did have track marks all up and down her arms all her life.
This production, as you said, is directed by Lonnie Price. You worked together with him on 110 in the Shade, but did you work to find that mix of vulnerability and fierceness that Billie Holiday had?
Absolutely. Aside from just bringing this project to me and being one of my dearest friends, Lonnie Price, he knows all of my tricks, so he's a great director to work with. So when we approached this play, we thought we're just going to have to slice it as thinly as possible so that we know what every single beat of every single syllable of every single word means in the moment. It's the only way to get through something like this, whereas just one long monologue with some songs interspersed. And so we're still working on it.
Well, you're not just giving us her voice, but also the way she moved. Mm-hmm. Your mouth takes on a kind of a twist.
Yeah, she had a little bit of a side smile, she'd have a big, broad smile, but a friend of hers that knew her well that we've also were able to talk to, a great lady named Yolande Bavan, she said she always looked like there was some joke she was thinking about. So use that. I use the fact that I talked to Dr. Maya Angelou before Dr. Maya Angelou passed. She gave me some insight into Billie and said that she, walked kind of in a very strained way because of all the swelling, of her legs and her feet because of the cirrhosis, you know, things like that.
You said that you think to yourself before you go on the stage, try to defend her, try to give her one last shot at defending herself.
Yeah.
Does she need defending from the audience?
Absolutely. She even said in April of 1959, I'm paraphrasing, but she said, I've got no understudy. Every time I go on stage to sing, I'm fighting against everything that's ever been written about me and said about me, and I have to fight to get the audience to listen to me with their own ears. And so that's sort of the mantra I've taken on.
So when she wrote God Bless the Child, that really is autobiographical.
Absolutely. If you look at her life with her parents, you know, it absolutely is. Absolutely.
There's a band behind you on the stage, including Shelton Becton playing Jimmy Powers, one of her pianists. She had very good accompanists.
Wonderful. Mal Waldron and Jimmy Rolls and Bobby Tucker. Incredible pianists.
But you also have a dog, Peppy.
Yeah, played by Roxy. So it's gender bending a little bit.
The dog is very well behaved.
She's fantastic. She's a rescue from Hurricane Katrina, actually. And this is not her first Broadway show. This isn't her first time to the rodeo. She was in Legally Blonde on Broadway. So she's quite mellow and has a wonderful time.
The cast recording is going to be a two-disc album recorded last week?
Yes, we did it live. We recorded two performances of the show. We really figured that was the best way to do it, as opposed to going into a studio and just me singing these songs out of context as Billy. We really needed the whole show.
So we're going to hear all the dialogue on the record as well.
Yeah.
But we just won't see your amazing physical performance.
No, you won't see that. You can imagine it.
This year, you're nominated for Best Actress in a Play because this is a play with music. Is there a big difference for you in performing a play with music versus being in a musical?
Well, yes, and I've done a play with music one other time. Masterclass was a play with music, very much so, where I had to sing really hard stuff, but I was singing in the moment, and that was exactly what the character was doing. Yes and no. I mean, in the end, you're, you know, still out there trying to portray a character and trying to bring forth the truth of the character. But what I find interesting about this particular play with music is usually in a musical, you know, you start to sing when you're expressing an emotion and you can't speak anymore. You've got to start singing, and it's inner thoughts and feelings and maybe things that are not actually being said in real life. In our play, whenever I start to sing, it's because I'm actually singing. More my thoughts and emotions come out when I'm speaking.
In the musical, there's usually this moment, this little lead-in where you say, you know, honey, I've been thinking that they say that.
Exactly.
You've taken on some amazing roles in last year's Bess in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, Ruth Younger in A Raisin in the Sun, now Billie Holiday. What's next? The run is only until August 10th.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go back out on the road with some concerts, and I don't ever want to leave theater. You know, I'd like to tackle more Shakespeare, and I just want to, what I say to everybody, but it really is the truth, I just want to keep evolving as an artist, so whatever comes my way that's going to challenge me is something I'll jump on for sure.
We're going to go out with your performance of Strange Fruit. You made a grimacy face. Why?
I hate listening to myself, especially in this
role. I saw
that
before. You pulled off the headphones while we were playing.
I hate it.
What, do you hear all the missed opportunities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I defy you to find a singer who doesn't feel the same way.
Well, I think it sounds pretty good.
Thank you.
Audra McDonald, Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill is at the Circle in the Square Theater on West 50th Street and Broadway until August 10th. You still have an opportunity to see her. People pay extra to sit in the nightclub?
In the tables. Yeah, they do. They pay extra.
And they get drinks and stuff.
They get drinks and they get much closer to the action. They become a part of the action.
Audra, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the trees.